Movement for 10 Musicians. That was the Ives Ensemble, Lawrence Crane. Seems obviously longer than what we've heard before up until now, but also somewhat of how should I say this? This sounds different to me than other pieces that you've done. Not only the ones that we've heard, but the ones that I know. Is this just me, or is the harmonic material here in a way? I don't know how to call it really, but it seems that it's richer or it's a bit more varied. Could it be?
I think it's certainly it's richer, I suppose, because it's a large ensemble. And actually, for many years, I didn't write for more than about 5 or 6 players.
And was this an ideology or?
No, it wasn't. It was simply because I wasn't asked to write by groups okay. who were more than 5 or 6 players. So at one point, you get all my catalogue into a sort of, you know, one little instrumentation, really. But actually, all my large pieces have large, in terms of number of players, have been commissioned by ensembles in the Netherlands. And the largest one that I've been commissioned here is my octet, which we're going to be playing at the end of the show.
Right.
So that's 8 players, obviously. But this one for 10 musicians, and I also wrote for the Dutch ensemble Orchestre Volharding, who are sadly now since disbanded.
Disbanded.
And Orchestre Ereprijs, that was 14 players. And an orchestral piece as well in the Netherlands for the Netherlands Radio Chamber Orchestra. And another, I've done another piece for the Ives Ensemble. So, yeah. So in terms of, anyway, what you describe as a richness there, I think it's just having a larger number of players, instruments to work with. But I don't think the material is different in many ways. I think of this piece as sort of both static and moving forward in a way. It's different at the end from how it is at the beginning, but essentially what's happened is we've kind of walked around an object or a number of objects and viewed it from different perspectives. We have traveled forward in time. There is a sort of process going on, but it couldn't really be described as a developmental process.
And how I see it. And do you find, quite a racy question before I ask it, but what is your problem with development? I know that's not really the political correct way to ask this question, but it obviously seems like a recurring theme.
It's because I think I feel myself coming from a sort of experimental background or tradition, if you like, where developing material is just not part of how one goes about things. But having said that, I mean, in more recent pieces, I've felt that to be more sense of, or actually other people have said that there seems to be more sense of forward motion, as it were. I mean, one thing about development is that I suppose because so many of my materials are static and particularly harmonically static, therefore the harmonic rhythm is slow. It gives less sort of room for movement, I suppose.
So if there is a development, it really pans out, or fans out, I should say, and then it feels as if it's developed differently in a different kind of time or a different kind of space.
Well, I think it does, but I don't see it as development, yeah. I see it as a sort of viewing an object and then viewing it from a... I see it as statement and then restatement and then another restatement, but all from different perspectives, using different instrumentations, different register. Register is quite important thing for me to define a structure. But I just would never see it as development, even though sometimes there is a sort of forward momentum of some sort.
I guess what my initial question relates to something that I would just like to read. This is the words of the composer Michael Pizarro over you. Yeah. This is as a program note for a concert that was given by an ensemble in Montreal of your pieces.
Core,
that's
K-O-R-E,
right.
Yeah. Right. Run by a composer called Michael Osterley and a pianist called Mark Carew.
And this, just because this piece, this movement, seems that it is actually going towards a closure in the real dramatic sense, or the dramatic narrative sense of a piece, which is in a way different than what I usually am used to from your music. But let's just read this from Michael Pizarro, and kind of maybe I'll relate it to that, maybe not. Just I'd like to read it in any sense. The music of Lawrence Crane is characterized by the extreme reduction of the surface texture, the use of exact repetition, and by a highly selective and idiosyncratic use of the tonal system. Such a description, whilst accurate enough, might apply quite well to a number of other composers, including, for example, the first generation of American minimalists or some of the music of Erik Satie. There we go again, twice. Yeah. And this, I suppose, is what is ultimately misleading about the attempt to describe those elements of the music which appear on the page. The outline is traced and the features are recorded, but something, perhaps the essential thing, is missing. And he goes on to say, the first thing to strike me about Crane's music was its familiarity. These pieces seem almost not to have been written, but found. I imagine someone entering a cluttered house built in turn-of-the-century Paris and very slowly and systematically removing whatever they didn't like. This mirror is too ornate, on the trash heap. Now this simple soap dish, this is beautiful. When I'm done cleaning this place out, this will be the only thing I keep in this room. In Crane's music, one meets old friends. Cadence formulas, sequences, little tunes, but here they are freed from the clutter that usually surrounds them. They are just on the verge of being completely ordinary, perhaps nicked from a basic harmony text somewhere. This is just beautiful, and I find this metaphor to Paris just a gorgeous metaphor.
Yeah.
And what this makes me feel is that when I listen to your music, sometimes I fill in my mind, or maybe even in song, I fill in something that I feel that this is a basis for. So it's like these minus one records, do you know that? You know, Beethoven's concerto without the piano part or something like this that you can play
right,
over
Yeah.
So I just find myself doing that a lot with your music, and I guess that with movement that didn't happen to me. And yet there is no melody per se, it's still the same harmonic progression. So I guess it seemed like a room just with a bit more objects in it. But I guess that does maybe relate to the fact that the orchestration is just a bit richer and...
I suppose it's because the basic material is very... there's two basic musical objects on which the piece is made out of, and they are very, very simple. It's just one being an ascending sequence of three chords, and the other being an alternating two chords in which there's just one semitone difference. There are two sections which sort of act as sort of pillars, really, which is this just as upward scale. In which that's the moment where the organ and the keyboard percussion come in for the first time. They really just offset the three major sections of the piece, which are dealing with these two objects. Gradually, I suppose these objects become merged in a sense that you can't fully tell which one is which after a while because they've sort of merged. But I think I would say that the richness of which you speak is a sort of instrumentation thing, and maybe also to do with the use of the electric organ, which is actually a sort of little obsession of mine.
Yeah, there's a fascination there, obviously. It's recurring in many of
maybe four or five pieces now. Actually, you'll hear it in the octet at the end
again,
of the program.
That's right.
And I'm sometimes asked about this, why I'm so interested in electric organ. I think it comes from a few things. One is it's an instrument that can sustain things for a long time, and that I'm very, very, very attracted to. The other thing is, from a classical point of view, I love pieces like Steve Reich's Four Organs, which is my favorite.
I like it the most than any of his other pieces. Hey, we should have this show more often. You could co-host me anytime you want.
And well, thirdly, because I grew up listening to a lot of rock organ, either in Bob Dylan or I'm going to admit this now, listening to a lot of progressive rock when I was a teenage.
We've all did
boy.
That. Yeah, that's just you were at the right age, at least. You know, I was going. This was not even retro in the early 90s when I was listening to like Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
That's true. Yeah, I was the right age in the 1970s. Yeah,
right.
But obviously, electric organs are plentiful.
And are these? I mean, because the organs that they use in prog rock are usually Hammonds, if I'm not mistaken. And is this the organ that you use when you use organs in your pieces?
Well, now I mean, we can use a synthesizer with an organ.
with that sound.
Sound, right. Yeah, a Hammond or a Farfisa.
Right, and this is what you stipulate in the scores, or what do
actually,
you...
I just the stipulation in the score is quite relaxed. It's sense that it's looking for a sustained rock organ type sound with. It doesn't. I mean, sometimes the pieces can sound slightly different because you know you have a wide range of sounds available. And I have there's a piece of mine called Rhys, which is a trio for clarinet, cello, and electric organ. And I have about five different recordings of different ensembles playing them, all with slightly different organ sounds. It does actually. So it interests me about these instruments: electric organ, electric guitar, accordion, those sort of instruments where there are a lot of unforeseen elements to the sound. You can pretty much predict, obviously, what a violin or a flute is going to sound like. But with those instruments, there are so many variables in different makes or different things that the player might use, like pedals or things. Then it adds a sort of element to the sound that is a bit unpredictable.
That's quite interesting.
I like that. Again, not to keep referring to it, but the piece Octet has that element in that when I merge the timbres of accordion, electric organ, and electric guitar, there are unforeseen sounds, definitely.
Just to make a note, because you've mentioned about stipulations or non-stipulations in your scores, I found this quite interesting from looking through the BMIC site. For those of you who are interested in going through Lawrence Crane's scores, just click on the info button on this page and you will get a link to some of the scores. I think up until a certain year, all of your scores are there.
They're all viewable online up to 2003.
Okay, So you can all do that and notice just that one thing that there's that minimal stipulation. Everything is there. It's not in any way kind of a aleatoric score, but it seems that it leaves so much breath, so much air, not really too much detail, very sparse on the details in that sense. And it's really quite interesting because you would think, I at least thought that there would be more detail as far as sound is concerned, but no, it really leaves a lot of space to the performer. I thought that was quite beautiful, really in an aesthetic level,
right,
of writing a score, because it's just really, not only is the music kind of taking you as a listener through this journey in which you, in a way, you're part of the piece, because it's just really out there like an object.
Yeah.
It's also that way for the musician, reading, interpreting the score. I find that that's quite amazing. Maybe this explains why so many musicians are actually interested in this music, because it really leaves that room, which relates quite directly to the next piece we'll be playing, because this is four miniatures from... Let's see, I've got this all written down. I just have to check it out. Don't tell me, Lawrence, it's 2003.
That is correct.
And this not only relates to, in a way, your past, because, again, four miniatures, very, very short movements. To me, it sounds like a different style as well. It sounds like a departure from your usual style, but maybe we'll go into that later. But more than anything, a very, very open space, an open score. Very, how shall I put it, a delicate situation to be in for a musician, I would say.
Very, very much, very delicate, yes.
Exposed, quite very exposed. Yeah.
Very exposed. The pieces were written for an English group called Nosferatu, run by the composer Joe Cutler. On the recording we're going to hear, actually, they're played by an ensemble called 175 East from Auckland in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
The scoring is for flute, violin, percussion and piano. But I decided to make, first of all, I wanted to make a set of pieces which were maybe between, you know, a minute and 2 minutes each. And I wanted each one to be based on a drone of some sort, where each player would be playing the drone. In each movement would be a different player playing the drone. It makes for a very exposed performance situation. Tuning is vital. Ensemble is completely crucial as being aware of what the other player is doing. And I think musicians have to be very brave to be able to play this music with commitment, because it's very exposed and there's nowhere to hide. And I'm extremely grateful to many of the fantastic musicians all the fantastic musicians who've played my work over the years.
And those to come. Let's give that a listen. So this again is four miniatures from 2003, played by 175. Is it 175 or 175? 175.
I think it's 175.
175. Yeah. Why are they called that way? Do you know?
175 East. Because it's to do with the I think it's the longitude of Auckland from Greenwich.
Ah, I see what you're saying. Could be.
Would
well,
that be right?
It is east from Greenwich, that I can tell you.
Yeah.
I can't tell you much more than that. A bit of a colonial guilt going on there, I would say.
I'd say
why,
so,
why is
yeah.
Greenwich in any
well,
way?
Well, actually, 175 East is run by an English composer called James Gardner, who actually moved to Auckland in 1992 and
really
this group. Yeah.
So it's all about homesickness, really.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, that's understandable. So here it is for you, four miniatures from 2003, 175 East, Lawrence Crane. four miniatures, 175 East, Lawrence Crane. So my question is, again, do you feel that this piece, that four miniatures, is a departure from materials that you've used in the past, for pieces of the past?
In a sense, yes, because I was I wanted each piece to be based on a drone, and the drone would be played by a different player each time. Actually, that didn't quite work, because in fact two pieces, the drone is played by a percussionist. But a percussion drone, an unpitched drone, is a role. In the case of the first one, which is very, very quiet, is a bass drum roll. And that piece does not sound normally what my music would sound like.
Yeah, I thought so as well.
Yeah. That and a piece called John White in Berlin, which I wrote in the same year, 2003. Again, also like movement. I think colour and texture becomes more important.
Right.
And in that sense, it's a departure. In other senses, it's not. I think it's not. It's not necessarily taking me anywhere else. Hmm. It's just something.
Because in a way, you've used the drone as in the same way as this kind of object. This is the material of the piece, as it were. This
yes.
Kind of the, rather than it being a chord or a harmonic structure or in directionality with chords, so it's kind of more sparse and hence sounds different. But in a way, it's pretty much the same compositional thought.
I would say so. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Very interesting piece. Yeah. But this relates to the fourth movement, because that drone is actually created by a technique that I think that you've invented. I don't think anybody else has used this.
Oh, I wouldn't like to claim that, actually.
No,
I,
really?
I think that Alvin Lucier invented the technique originally.
Oh damn him.
The technique we're talking about is using a device called an e-bow or electronic bow.
Yeah, usually used in probably rock guitars.
It's a device invented for guitarists and enables them to play a note using infinite sustain.
So it kind of, if I understand correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, it's a battery powered sort of gadget you place on the strings, and it vibrates the strings ever so lightly so that the string creates a vibration and sound, but you're not plucking the string, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes, it's magnetic.
Exactly.
So it makes the string vibrate through its magnetic device.
That's used in the fourth movement of miniatures, also used in quite extensively, I should say, in John White in Berlin.
Yes. I mean, I think when you very kindly said that I invented the technique, it was the idea of putting it in a piano. Because they're not made for piano, they're invented for guitarists.
Right.
But I had the idea for the piece John White in Berlin, which was written maybe 3 or 4 months earlier than the piece we've just heard, Four Miniatures. I had the idea of putting in four e-bows. They're very expensive, by the way, so I had to borrow them from people. inside the piano, on the piano strings. And the reason that is actually quite difficult sometimes is because they're not made exactly to fit piano strings. There's always a possibility that they might actually fall off. But fortunately, we've kept them on in most occasions. By putting four e-bows on the strings, I could make a chord sound for a long time. And when you depress the pedal, it activates the notes. You don't have to actually play any notes on the keyboard. You depress the pedal, and the e-bows start to work.
Hmm.
In the fourth movement of Four Miniatures, I again use a single e-bow. I use four e-bows for John White in Berlin, and also the guitarist in John White in Berlin is playing with an e-bow as well. So there's five in the entire piece. But in just one in the piano for Four Miniatures, and it sustains the note G through that fourth movement,
right,
which is that movement's particular drone.
Yes, for those of you, just like to make a mention, for those of you who want to hear John White in Berlin, this is a piece that I've actually programmed before, not on an hour, but just in a program dedicated to the Norwegian ensemble Asamisi Maza. The last piece on that program is this piece, John White in Berlin, which was performed by the same ensemble. I will ask my producer to put that program on after our program when it's posted. This will give you an indication, our listeners, to how much pull I have in Khalas Radio. For those of you who are interested in pretty much an hour or more of music in order to hear this wonderful piece, I have to say, it's one of the first pieces of yours I've heard, John White in Berlin. It's really quite mesmerizing. I'd like to take us probably to the finale of today, which is Octet. We've talked about this before. We've mentioned it before.
Yep.
But this is going to be the longest piece that we've played today. This is the Octet from 2008. So also the most recent piece from you on this program, I think.
It is, yes.
Yes.
Yes, piece I wrote last year for Plus Minus Ensemble, who are an ensemble who are run by the composers Joanna Bailey and Matthew Schlomowitz.
It's kind of a sort of Belgian-English connection, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, well, a Belgian, English, Australian, American. It's a very widespread group.
Nice.
Yeah, Joanna Bailey's a composer who works in Belgium, and Matthew works here in London, but he's Australian.
Huh, I didn't know that.
And some of the players are Australian, and one is American, I think. Oh, we actually had a Norwegian cellist from Massa, Tanya Orning, playing in this performance.
Oh, nice.
So there we go. There's an Ebow connection here with this piece, because the instrumentation is a clarinet, doubling bass clarinet, electric guitar, electric organ, again, doubling piano, accordion, violin, cello, and then Matthew and Joanna themselves playing auxiliary instruments, which is a particular feature of Plus Minus Ensemble. They do a lot of open scores where they can invent their instruments to decide what they're going to play.
Right.
In this case, their auxiliary instruments are actually pre-recorded drones that surface at various times during the single movement. And a sort of homemade percussion of small wooden chopping boards played with greaseproof kitchen paper in one situation, and in another situation with a £1 coin.
Specifically a £1 coin.
Well, it could,
can't be done with a euro.
It actually could be done with a euro. It's less, I think a euro is quite
it's
less.
It's a thin coin, the euro. It's very sexy.
Yeah,
it's a European coin, after all.
It's certainly a sexy coin, yeah. But you couldn't, I don't think you could get the same sort of slight coarseness of the pound.
Yes, the pound is, of course, I love the pound. It really gets, it gives you the feeling of money, you know? It's heavy, it's there. And this harp drone, you've also created this with the use of the Ebow. It works on a harp as well.
Well, the pre-recorded drones in Octet, which are being controlled by, they're on normal sort of CD players, they are made by a harp. Goes back to a piece I wrote in 2004 for the harpist, harp player Rodri Davis. Mm-hmm. And that was for live harp and pre-recorded part. The pre-recorded part was generated entirely from the sound of Ebows on the low strings of the harp. The low strings of the harp are metal.
Right, so it wouldn't work really on the ones that are kind of plastic?
No, it wouldn't. Yeah. And incidentally, Ebows in the piano only work on a certain range where you get the triple strings. You couldn't put them on the big, thick single strings.
It would reverberate too much. It would...
Or they would definitely fall off then.
Right.
Yeah. But with the metal strings, the low octave of the harp are metal. The strings are metal.
Yeah.
And you can use Ebows on those. And for this piece, which is called Single Harmony for Rodri Davis, as I wrote in 2004, I used, I recorded these, Rodri and I recorded these drones using the Ebows, and constructed a pre-recorded part for a performance of the piece. I like the drones so much that I wanted to use them in octet, so I extended them in duration. And they surface. They're slightly at odds with the harmony of the piece at times, and they're slightly skew, I suppose, to the general harmony.
Right.
But they play an important part in the texture of the piece and the richness of the piece. I think.
Yeah, I'm sure our listeners will be able to hear that, because it's a very prominent feature in this piece.
Yes.
And in a way, I'm very happy about closing with this piece, because it in a way encapsulates all of the elements of not only the pieces that we've heard today, but in a way, many of the elements that are featured in your music at large, and indeed a piece that's very recent in its time of composition,
yes.
Also a very large piece. And makes me wonder, just as a final question, plans for the future, if now it is about bigger pieces, larger forms.
I'm interested now in larger forms. Yeah, right. Having been a miniaturist for many years, I've now become interested in making larger forms. And this piece is certainly, I feel, is some sort of way forward for me. Also, the piano piece that I talked about earlier, the new piano piece.
Right.
But in this piece, because I'm interested in placing things next to each other and seeing how they work and jump cutting, if you like, to other things. And just creating, there are also tempo changes which were absent from my music for many years. You know, there are tempo changes within the piece. And so, this is definitely what I'm interested in trying to make larger forms out of the same sort of material and trying to work out a way of doing that.
No atonal kind of crazy dodecaphonic pieces in your future? Do you foresee that?
Never say never.
Never say never, right.
Absolutely.
Okay, I like that. Just as a final question, what is the fascination? It's related, of course, to the first piece that we heard, and I'm going back to that, but what is the fascination with sports? You've dedicated more than, well, the large piano piece that we've talked about, just performed in the Cutting Edge concert, our first piece from today. I think there's a few more, I just can't remember right now.
Yeah, well, I use, in my titles quite often, I use names, places. And I'm a big follower of professional road cycling. Some cyclist names have found their way into the pieces. But really, I should emphasize this: I'm not painting a picture of that world. It's just simply that I like to sort of take things from as just ways of naming pieces.
Right.
You know, I like the sound of names, or I like the sound of certain things. To me, they're still entirely abstract pieces concerned only with music. They're not tone poems about sport.
Okay. No, sorry that I've divulged into that just now. It just really was on my mind, and I thought, oh, I didn't mention this. And
that's fine.
There's so much to do with sports.
Yeah.
Here is a really abstract name, Octet. And
quite literally a composition for eight players.
Exactly. And I'll just leave you, our listeners, with that piece. It's quite long. It's 17 minutes, and it just really leaves you with this feeling or this taste of Lawrence Crane. But let me thank you very so much, Lawrence Crane, for coming here today and being my guest and taking the time and playing us this wonderful music and writing this wonderful music, which I feel is just everybody should be listening to. I feel that more people should be listening to, and hopefully they will.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. So until our next time, I'm signing off for today. This is Miofir Olzetsky. And on our next journey into contemporary music, you will be hearing me again with some other composer, hopefully. Until that time, all the best.
Hour was an Anechoic transmission brought to you by Radio Halas.